Esther chapter 1, as we said last week, the book of Esther is about the faithfulness of God towards his people. Right? Faithfulness worked out in the invisible hand of providence. God's providence is one of those overarching themes in the book, and I'm going to mention it again and again as we work our way through it. I'm doing this so that we as a people get a better hand, a better grip on this concept of providence. It's really a wonderful reality that we sometimes forget. But we should keep this ever before us. The providence of God is meant to be a source of great comfort for us. In fact, the Heidelberg Catechism, questions number 27 and 28, address the issue of providence. Question 27, what do you understand by the providence of God? Answer, providence is the almighty and ever-present power of God by which he upholds, as with his hand, heaven and earth and all creatures, and so rules them that leaf and blade, rain and drought, fruitful and lean years, food and drink, health and sickness, prosperity and poverty, all things, in fact, come to us, not by chance, but from his fatherly hand. Question 28, how does the knowledge of God's creation and providence help us? Answer, we can be patient when things go against us, thankful when things go well, and for the future we can have good confidence in our faithful God and Father that nothing will separate us from his love. All creatures are so completely in his hand that without his will, they can never move nor be moved. Beloved, there is nothing that happens in our lives, nothing that happens in our lives that is by chance. There is nothing outside of God's purview and God's providence, and this is meant to be a great comfort for us. Walter Elwell said, providence is the sovereign, divine superintendence of all things, guiding them toward their divinely predetermined end in a way that is consistent with their created nature, and all to the glory and praise of God. This divine, sovereign, benevolent control of all things by God is the underlying premise of everything that is taught in the Scriptures. And that is so. In Genesis 22, when Abraham took Isaac atop Mount Moriah, and in order to sacrifice him, as per the command of the Lord, Isaac said, Father, behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering? To which Abraham replied, God will provide for himself the lamb for the burnt offering, my son. And he did. Just before Abraham plunged the knife into his son, the angel stayed his hand, and Abraham lifted up his eyes, and it says, behold, there was a ram caught in the thicket by the horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered it up for the burnt offering in the place of his son. Beloved, that wasn't a miracle. God didn't just zap the ram into existence. No, it was orchestrated by the hand of providence. Right? In the plans and purposes of God, in a way that is consistent with the created order of the world of the ram, God had a ram up on the mountain. And God had a ram get stuck in the thicket at just the appropriate place and time that Abraham would be there with his son. Just in time for him to lift his eyes up and see what he needed. That is the providence of God. The invisible hand of God working according to his created order, governing it, superintending it, in order to bring it about to its desired end. And for the believer and for all of God's people, that desired end is for our good and for his glory. And see, this is what we see in Esther chapter 1. This is the setup for chapter 2, where Esther becomes the new queen. And thus, she assumes then a position of influence over the king so that she can, in time, deliver God's people who are on the brink of extinction. This is the backstory to her ascendancy. Now, backstories are quite the thing right now, right? If you're a moviegoer or you like to read books, right, there are backstories all over the place. Backstories on Star Wars, backstories on Marvel characters, right? Backstories to Batman characters, right? Backstories fill the gaps. They explain how things came to be, how persons, how events came to be. Esther 1 is the backstory to how Esther became the queen of Persia. And here we see the invisible hand of God at work, governing and guiding and providing for his people in a most peculiar way. Here he is superintending the personal and public affairs of a pagan king to put his person in the right place at the right time. Now this morning we're just going to walk through the chapter. It's pretty self-explanatory, and I'm just going to fill in some of the historical and cultural gaps for you and then point out some of the subtleties of the text. You'll notice that there are no commands in the text. There are no exhortations, no promises to claim. It's just a backstory that shows us that the invisible hand of God is at work. And that hand is written all over the text. And I hope this helped you see that this morning. So I'm gonna throw a lot out at you. Just sit back. We're not going to jump around a whole lot of places. Just sit back, maybe take some notes, and stay with me as we move through this chapter. Now it happened, verse 1, in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was at the citadel in Susa, in the third year of his reign, he held a feast for all his princes and servants, the military officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his provinces being in his presence. And while he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, in fact, 180 days. And when these days were fulfilled, the king held a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present at the citadel in Susa, from the greatest to the least. In the court of the garden of the king's palace, there were hangings of fine white and blue linen held by cords of fine purple linen on silver rings and marble pillars, and couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry and marble, mother of pearl and precious stones. And drinks were served in golden vessels of various kinds, and the royal wine was plentiful according to the king's hand, and the drinking was done according to the law. There was no compulsion, for so the king had established it for each official in his house of his household, that he should do according to what pleased each person. Queen Vashti also held a feast for the women in the royal house which belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he set for Mahuman, Bistha, Harbon, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagatha, Zethar, and Carcass, the 7 eunuchs who attended to the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful in appearance. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the word of the king, which was delivered by the hand of the eunuchs. And then the king became exceedingly furious, and his wrath burned within him. Then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for it was the custom of the king thus to speak before all who knew the law and justice and were close to him, Karshina, Sethar, Adamatha, Tarshish, Maris, Marcina, and Memucan, the seven princes of Persia and Media who had access to the king's presence and sat in the first place in the kingdom. According to the law, what is to be done with Queen Vashti? Because she did not do the declaration of King Ahasuerus delivered by the hand of the eunuchs. And then in the presence of the king and the princes, Memucan said, Queen Vashti has committed iniquity against not only the king, but also against all the princes and all the peoples who are in the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the word about the queen will get out to all the women, causing them to despise their husbands in their eyes by saying, King Ahasuerus said for Queen Vashti to be brought to his presence, but she did not come. This day the ladies of Persia and Media who have heard of the word about the queen will speak in the same way to all the king's princes, and there will be plenty of spite and indignation. If it seems good to the king, let the royal word go forth from him and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media so that it cannot be repealed, that Vashti may no longer come into the presence of King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. And the king's sentence, which he will make, will be heard throughout all of his kingdom, for it is vast, and all the women will give respect to their husbands, great and small. And this word was good in the eyes of the king and the princess. And the king did according to the word of Memucan. So he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province according to its script, and to every people according to their tongue, that every man should be a ruler in his own house, and the one who speaks in a tongue, and the one who speaks in the tongue of his own people. Now, as a reader, we are meant to be impressed by the pomp and power of the Persian king. We are also meant to chuckle at how very fragile and insignificant it all is. Fragile in that here is a king who, for all intents and purposes, is the ruler of the world, who, because of a foolish dispute with his wife, has threatened the balance of power in the whole kingdom. And insignificant in that, despite the pomp and the power of the king, unbeknownst to him, there is a higher throne at work behind the scenes, putting his people into place. Now, if you remember from our studies from the book of Daniel, and you can actually turn to Daniel chapter 7 for a minute. If you remember from those studies, chapters 2 and 7 of Daniel are parallel in that they describe the same content, though with different emphases. Chapter 2 is Nebuchadnezzar's dream of a four-part statue. Chapter 7 is Daniel's vision of the four beasts. Each of the four parts of those dream and the vision correspond with the four parts of the other. They represent different world kingdoms that are successive and that end with the triumph of God's eternal kingdom. The first kingdom is Babylon. The second kingdom is the Medo-Persian kingdom. The third kingdom is Greece, and the fourth is Rome. Chapter 2 of Daniel emphasizes the broad view of Gentile history until the kingdom of God. It covers the whole span of human history. Chapter 7 focuses in on the last Gentile kingdom of that history, the kingdom that is present right before the kingdom of God. By the time we get to the historical time period of the book of Esther, the first kingdom has been subsumed by the second. The Medo-Persian Empire is now the empire in place, and it's well underway. It was the reigning empire from 539 BC to 331 BC. And then it was defeated by Alexander the Great. You remember Daniel's description of this kingdom in chapter 7, verse 5. He says, "And behold, another beast, a second one in the likeness of a bear. And it was raised up on one side, and three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth. And thus they said to it, arise, devour much meat. In chapter 8, in the first section there, in the third year of the reign of Belshazzar the king, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, after one which appeared to me previously, and I looked in the vision, and it happened that while I was looking, I was in the citadel of Susa, which is in the province of Elam, and I looked in the vision, and I myself was beside the Ulai Canal. Then I lifted my eyes and looked, and behold, a ram which had two horns was standing in front of the canal. Now, the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last. And I saw the ram butting westward, northward, and southward, and no other beast could stand before it, nor was there any to deliver from its power. And it did as it pleased and magnified itself. And while I was considering, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. Then it came up to the ram that had the two horns, which I had seen standing in front of the canal, and ran at it with his strong wrath. And I saw it reach the side of the ram, and it was enraged at it. And it struck the ram and broke its two horns in pieces, and the ram had no strength to stand in opposition to it, so it threw it down to the ground and trampled on it, and there was none to deliver the ram from its power. Then the male goat magnified itself exceedingly, but as soon as it was mighty, the large horn was broken, and in its place there came up four conspicuous horns towards the four winds of heaven. If you note verse 20 of the same chapter, it will give the interpretation of the ram. We notice that in both of those descriptions in Daniel, both in chapter 7 and in chapter 8, it depicts something staggered. In chapter 7, it's a lopsided bear, right? One side being higher than the other side. In chapter 8, we see a two-horned ram with a second horn longer than the other, longer than the first. That is a depiction. Both of those are depictions of the Medo-Persian Empire. Two peoples, the Medes and the Persians, both related ethnically, but united under one kingdom, yet one line of descent was greater than the other. In the book of Daniel, it is always referred to as the Medo-Persian Empire, the Medes being the primary locus of power. Led by Cyrus the Great in 339, they dethroned Babylon and became the second Gentile world power in Daniel's list. By the time you get to the end of the book of Esther, the locus of power had switched to the Persians. And thus we find it always referred to as Persia and Media. Chapter 1, verse 3 of Esther, verse 14, verse 18, verse 19. By the time we get to the book of Esther, the Persian influence was the greater locus of power of that empire. So even before we get to Ahasuerus, right, God had been working and at work orchestrating the end that he had decided from the beginning, right, putting his people in place and doing so according to his word that he had given to his people. Now we fast forward in Esther 55 years to the days of Ahasuerus in Esther 1. And in verses 1 through 4, he says, now it happened in the days of Ahasuerus, the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. In those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was at the citadel of Susa, in the third year of his reign, he held a feast for all his princes and servants, the military officers of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of his province being in his presence, while he displayed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, 180 days. The it, as in now it happened, verse 1, is a reference to what happened at the feast. right? The call for and the refusal of Vashti, and then her subsequent deposition. This chapter is all about her deposition and the need for a replacement. Ahasuerus was the Persian king from 486 BC to 465 BC. He inherited the throne from his father Darius I, Darius Hystaspes. He was the grandson of Cyrus the Great through Cyrus's daughter Atossa. His Persian name was Kashyarsha, and he was known by the Greeks as Xerxes, which has a similar sound to the Persian name. Unfortunately, the translators of the Septuagint, along with their many additions to the Book of Esther, mistakenly refer to him as Artaxerxes, which was Xerxes' son. That was the Artaxerxes I, who was the king at the time of Nehemiah. Xerxes is mentioned again in the Old Testament in Ezra 4, verse 6, and then Daniel 11. We'll look at it later. But while there were other rulers by the name of Ahasuerus, we note that this one is distinguished by the note about the size of his realm. The Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces. Now, this is meant to impress. This is meant to impress us with the size and the wealth and the power of his kingdom. Just a little history about Ahasuerus. If you were just to read the Greek historians, Herodotus et al. Of them, you might walk away with a less than favorable view of Xerxes I. Of course, the Greeks were less than favorable about anyone but themselves, but that's beside the point. Xerxes was particularly the butt of the Greek jokes because he, along with his father Darius I, suffered a couple humiliating defeats at the hands of the Greeks. Darius I lost the first battle against the Greeks in 490 at the Battle of Marathon. And trying to redeem the Persian name in 481 BC, Ahasuerus conducted his own campaign against the Greeks with an estimated 200,000 men and a navy of a couple hundred ships. The long and short of it is that though the Persians vastly outnumbered the Greeks, after 2 days of fierce battle, they were held at Thermopylae, having suffered an enormous loss of men. If you've seen the movie The Last Samurai, this is the battle that they're talking about at the end of the movie. The numbers aren't quite as accurate in the movie, nor in the Greeks, right? The Greeks in the movie say 2 million men were defeated. That's not so. It was more like 200,000. But that is still a lot of men. And so forced to retreat, Xerxes made his way back to Asia Minor, and lost more men to sickness and starvation. And there on the coast of Asia Minor, Xerxes had the privilege of having a front row seat to watch his navy get sunk at Salamis at the end of 480. So deciding it was time to come home, Xerxes left his general Mardonius in charge of the army, who led it to defeat in the next year in 479 BC. So thus, the Persian army, which was far superior on paper, ended their invasion of Greece, suffering humiliating defeats under both Darius I and his son Xerxes. Now that's what Xerxes is most famous for. And since the Greeks wrote the history books, this is how he will most always be remembered. But that is not all there is to say about Xerxes or Ahasuerus. For the last 12 years of Darius's reign, Xerxes served as viceroy over Babylon. This is where he gained his governing skills. And right after he ascended to the throne, when his father died, both Egypt and Babylon revolted. Xerxes quickly put an end to the rebellion and severely punished the perpetrators. And though he could not defeat the Greeks, he did consolidate the kingdom. And he did complete the building projects that his father had begun, the chief one being the royal palace at Persepolis. Xerxes was a highly competent, and aside from the debacle at Greece, a highly successful man. His empire stretched from India to Ethiopia. That is a massive amount of land. No other Persian monarch had that kind of success. Now, if you have maps in your Bible, right, see if there's a map of the Persian Empire or a map of the nations, the table of nations of Genesis chapter 10. If you don't have maps, Google this when you get home. Google the Persian Empire under Xerxes 1. If you got a study Bible, you'll probably have a map somewhere in your notes in Ezra or Esther, maybe even Daniel. If all you have is the map in the back called the Table of the Nations of Genesis 10, right? If that's all that you have, you'll notice that on the right side of that map, right where it probably ends, you'll have the area of Elam. Right? Elam is at the center of the empire. Right? It stretched the same distance to the east as it did to the west. Seriously, this is a massive amount of land and a massive amount of different people groups. Running west to east, the Persian Empire covered from the islands off the west coast of Asia Minor all the way to the Indus River, which is in the middle of modern-day Pakistan. Running north and south, it covered from the Black Sea, the Caspian Sea, the Aral Sea in the north, all the way to the region of the Upper Nile south of Egypt, which was Cush on that map of Genesis 10. That is now northern Sudan. This was an enormous empire. It was comprised of over 127 provinces. Now, for a number of years, critics of the Bible saw this number in Esther, 127 provinces, and they laughed at it because Herodotus only recorded 27 satrapies under Darius the First. But see, there is a difference between Herodotus' satrapies and Esther's provinces. The satrapy refers to a larger unit of taxation, whereas the Hebrew province referred to the smaller political units of his empire. Hence, the province was a subdivision of the satrapy. Again, this is an enormous amount of land covering many different peoples. And when it came to empires in the ancient world, Xerxes was the top dog. In fact, he gave himself the title King of Kings. He introduced himself as I, the mighty king, king of kings, king of populous countries, king of this great and mighty earth, far and near. And this is what the writer is depicting here for us in verse 1. The greatness of Ahasuerus. And he does so by going on to tell us about this feast. He says, in those days, as King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne, which was at the citadel in Susa, in the third year of his reign, he held a feast for all his princes and military officers, the nobles and princes of his provinces being in his presence. And he displayed all of his riches, the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days, for 180 days. Have you ever seen a movie or a cartoon of a royal city in Arabia? I think of Disney's Aladdin. Right, you'll see a city that's with a palace in the midst of it. Right, and the palace is usually raised up on a piece of land, so it sits noticeably higher than the rest of the city, and the palace is walled to protect those who are in it, and the wealth displayed by the palace is exponentially greater than the city down below. This was the case for the palace of Susa and for all Persian palaces. Susa, or Shushan in the Hebrew, was both the name of the city and the name of the palace. It was the royal capital of the Persian Empire. 200 miles north in the mountains was Akbaktana, the summer residence. 300 miles southeast would one day be Persepolis. The word citadel refers to a fortified area, an acropolis. You can Google this later too and see the archaeological data on it. The palace complex was a rectangular shape and it was raised 120 feet above the rest of the city. It had a huge wall around it, 2.5 miles long. And within that wall was a large garden surrounding the palace with the palace in the middle. And it was all designed to display the greatness of the king. As one person said, the elevated palace complex within a city was designed both to suggest the majestic grandeur of the king and to provide for his protection. In the third year of the king, verse 3, this would make it 483 BC. And if you're doing the math, this would make it approximately 3 years before his invasion of Greece. And given the invitees here, the princes, the servants, the military officers, the nobles of his provinces, it's probably correct to assume that the feast was designed to garner support for and to share his plans for invading Greece. Herodotus says Xerxes, being about to take in hand the expedition against Athens, called together an assembly of the noblest Persians to learn their opinions and to lay before them his own designs. So when the men were met, the king spoke thus to them, "My intent is to throw a bridge over the Hellespont and march an army through Europe against Greece, and thereby I may obtain vengeance from the Athenians for the wrongs committed by them against the Persians and against my father." It would take time to collect money and men for the battle. It would take careful planning to bring it about. A show of pomp and power was designed to assist him in making his case. Now, there is some debate here about what exactly took place. Was it a 6-month long feast? Is there a feast in verse 3 and then another one mentioned in verse 5? Or is that the same one? Or are there two feasts with the one in verse 5 coming at the end of the 6 months? Probably best to understand this, both references there to the feast as referring to the same feast. Verse 4 being a kind of parenthetical note, for 180 days, 6 months, he put his pomp and power on display. Right? He invited everyone who was anybody to come and view his greatness. Right? They came in waves. It was a great exhibition of glory and greatness of Ahasuerus. Right? A chance to see it for themselves and enjoy it. It's like the great exhibition of London in 1851. For 5 months, it was a place to come and view the industrial achievements of people and nations from all over the world. Prince Albert personally designed it for people to come and see what was there and also to recognize the superior achievements of Great Britain. This is what was happening in Susa. Only all the glory and all the greatness and all the wealth of the nations belonged to Ahasuerus. It was where he displayed, verse 4, the riches of his royal glory and the splendor of his great majesty for many days. And at the end of that, when it was all said and done, he held a feast, a banquet, a drinking party that lasted 7 days. It was a time to discuss the plans of state, right? The nitty-gritty of the invasion. The royal wine was plentiful, verse 7. That's a picture of great generosity, and the golden vessels were used to serve it. It was an impressive display of his authority and achievements. Right? He and his family might not have been able to conquer Greece up to this point, but they had conquered everyone else. Right? The feast and the exhibition were there to show it. It was all extravagance, opulence, luxury. It was there to impress. In fact, in one of the other references to Ahasuerus in Daniel 11, it says, Daniel says, "Now I, in the first year of Darius the Mede, I stood to strengthen and to be a fortress for him." So faithful Daniel was, always faithful to his superiors. Lots of Darius's in the Medo-Persian history. The first year of Darius the Mede was 536 BC, so this was 50 years plus before the events of Esther 1. And so verse 2 comes in and says, "So now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to stand in Persia." That was Cambyses, Gumata, and Darius the First. "Then a fourth king will reign far, will gain far more riches than all of them." That is Xerxes. "And soon he, and as soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will rouse the whole empire against the kingdom of Greece." This is Ahasuerus. He's displaying his riches. He's displaying his power. He's displaying his achievements. Word of God is so accurate here. The providence of God so relentless, putting Ahasuerus in place to fulfill his will. And then back in Esther, verses 5 through 9 depict the actual banquet. "And when these days were fulfilled, the king held a feast lasting 7 days for all the people who were present at the citadel in Susa, from the greatest to the least. In the court of the garden of the king's palace, there were hangings of fine white and blue linen held by cords of fine purple linen on silver rings, and marble pillars and couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement, precious stones. Drinks were served in the golden vessels of various kinds, and royal wine was plentiful according to the king's hand, and the drinking was done according to the law. There was no compulsion, for so the king had established it for each official in his household that he should do according to what pleased each person. And Queen Vashti also held a feast for the women in the royal house which belonged to King Ahasuerus." Records of the Persian kings depict feasts with up to 15,000 in attendance. One was said to be a 10-day feast for the celebration of 70,000 guests. Xerxes opened it up to his nobles here, his mighty men, and everyone else in Susa. Notice the opulence of the garden scene, hangings of fine white and blue linen held by cords of fine purple linen, and on silver strings and marble pillars, white and blue, were the royal colors of Persia. Karpas was fine linen, which was fastened to pillars with silver rings to hold them in place. The dye used for the purple linen was exquisite and incredibly expensive. It was extracted from sea animals found on the Phoenician coast and in the western Mediterranean Sea over 650 miles away from Susa. To extract the dye was extensive. Jewish sources claim that the marble pillars were the ones that Nebuchadnezzar seized from Babylon, which were the ones that Nebuchadnezzar seized from Solomon's temple and brought back to Babylon. The mosaic floors consisted of four kinds of precious stone. The first was a maroon-colored rock. The marble was white. The mother of pearl was that lustrous, iridescent part of the shell. The precious stones were black or black-flecked marble. Couches of gold and silver was not an exaggeration either. Herodotus noted that when the Persians fled from Greece, the Greeks raided their camp to find many tents richly adorned with furniture of gold and silver, many couches covered with plates of the same, and many golden bowls, goblets, and other drinking vessels. You can Google it to see a picture of them. And the king's generosity in giving out the wine in verses 7 and 8 is another picture of his greatness. This is a display of unparalleled greatness in the ancient world, of authority. It was a display meant to impress. And then verse 9, we have a note about Queen Vashti. She also held a feast for the women in the royal house, which belonged to Ahasuerus. Vashti is the Persian name meaning desired one, beloved, beautiful one, best. Herodotus makes no mention of Vashti, but called her by called the Persian queen a mistress. It could be that there was more than one queen. It could be that the queen had more than one name. Herodotus describes her as a cruel woman. He said she was that she had the mother of her husband's lover brutally mutilated and once buried 14 noble Persian men alive. One point of interest with respect to the mention of her feast is that it was the custom of Persian women to feast with their men. The fact that they are not together here is a subtlety that comes out as an oddity in the story. It betrays a subtle distance between them that will become fully blossomed by the end of the chapter. All is not well in paradise. All is not well in Ahasuerus' home. Now, as we move to the rest of the chapter here, listen to what one writer says. This is very perceptive, and I think how we need to see the rest of this. He says, in verses 10 through 22, God moves those outcomes as well as choices to achieve His goals for the purposes and for the good of His people. What makes this particular section all the more amazing is that the decisions are being made by unbelievers, that is, those who have no comprehension or no interest in who God is and how He is controlling the destiny of a still as yet to as a yet unmentioned people in the book, the Jews. That's it. That's the genius of this backstory. God was superintending the decisions and the outcomes of the events and setting us up for chapter 2. The next scene in verses 10 through 12 is the turning point of the chapter. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he said to his men and the seven eunuchs who attended the presence of King Ahasuerus to bring in Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people and the princes, for she was beautiful in appearance. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the word of the king, which was delivered by the hand of the eunuchs. And then the king became exceedingly furious, and his wrath burned within him. The word merry there in verse 10 is the Hebrew word tov. Tov is the word that means good. It's used, I think, four more times in this chapter, a total of 23 times in the rest of the book. And in fact, it is a key word in the book, ranging anywhere in meaning from drunk to cheerful to beautiful, verse 11, to good, verse 19. In fact, verses 10 and 21 form a literary unit framed by the word good, tov. The heart of the king was good with wine, i.e. he was drunk. And like Solomon said, it made a mockery of him. Proverbs 20, verse 1. Wine is a mocker. Strong drink is a brawler, and whoever is intoxicated by it is not wise. Proverbs 23, verse 29 and 30. Who has woe? Who has sorrow? Who has contentions? Who has complaining? Who has wounds without cause? Who has redness of eyes? Those who linger long over wine. Those who go to taste mixed drinks. Verse 32, at the last it bites like a serpent and stings like a viper. In fact, the mother of Lemuel had some words for the king on this. Proverbs 31, verse 4 and 5. It is not for kings, O Lemuel. It is not for kings to drink wine or for rulers to desire strong drink, for they will drink and forget what is decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. Don't be foolish, young people. Strong drink and drunkenness leads to sorrow, strife, wounds without cause. It is a mocker. It is a brawler. It perverts justice and impairs judgment. And in the end, it delivers a deadly sting. It is not for kings or rulers or people in authority. And yet Ahasuerus and all his nobles are drunk. It was custom for Persian nobles to discuss the matters of state under the state of intoxication. And here in the midst of his nobles and his mighty men, Ahasuerus took it too far. He called his trusted, his advisors, the seven eunuchs, and commanded them to go into the palace to the other banquet, retrieve Queen Vashti, and bring her in to display her beauty. Now, the author of Esther is a bit vague here. What exactly Ahasuerus had in mind isn't spelled out for us. The author makes a special point of focusing on her beauty in verse 11, right? He mentions it twice, the last time with emphasis. Later, Jewish commentators suggest that he was demanding that she appear unclothed before them. Probably so, or close to that. The king put everything on display, right? All his riches, all his power. Why not his wife? Let his nobles gawk at her. Let them wish they had Queen Vashti as a wife. But she refused. In front of all his nobles, in front of all his dignitaries, all the men who were there to recognize that Ahasuerus had the world at his fingertips, she gave the word that she wasn't about to come in the room. Beloved, this is hilarious as a sort. The one thing that this self-proclaimed King of Kings couldn't control was his house, his wife. Now, we don't know why she refused. Text doesn't say. It could have been that she feared losing her dignity. It could have been that she was done taking orders. The text has already noted that there was some distance between them, verse 9. Whatever the case, she refused, which was no small matter. And the king went ballistic. End of verse 12. Then the king became exceedingly furious, and his wrath burned within him. Baldwin describes it this way. Regarding Vashti, as his most precious treasure, the king wanted to bring his great exhibition to a climax by displaying her beauty. Her impertinence in refusing to appear, so humiliating the king in front of all the leaders of his realm, was predictably dangerous on her part. The omission of any reason strengthens the tension of the story by implying that Vashti had no rights in relation to her husband, and therefore reasons were irrelevant. See, it didn't matter what her reasons were, whether they were noble or not. She did the one thing that Ahasuerus couldn't tolerate. She refused to obey him. And she did it publicly before all of his noble subjects. And the ramifications were huge. So fragile is the empire of the world. A stupid request by a king, a refusal by his queen, and the whole empire is on the verge of cultural collapse, a cultural collapse of power here. Verse 13, then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, knew culture, knew what to do, for it was the custom of the king thus to speak before all who knew the law and justice and were close to him. Then he names them. seven princes of Persia and Media who had access to the king's presence and sat in the first place in the kingdom according to the law, what is to be done with Queen Vashti because she did not do the declaration of the king, King Ahasuerus, delivered by the hand of the eunuchs. Then in the presence of the king and the princes, Memucan said, Queen Vashti has committed iniquity against not only the king, but also against all the princes and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. For the word about the queen will get out to all the women, causing them to despise their husbands in their eyes by saying, King Ahasuerus said to Queen Vashti to be brought into his presence, but she did not come. This day, the ladies of Persia and Media who have heard of the word about the queen will speak in the same way to all their king's princes, and there will be plenty of spite and indignation. If it seems good to the king, let a royal word go forth from him, and let it be written in the laws of the Persia and Media, so that it cannot be repealed, that Vashti may no longer come into the presence of King Ahasuerus. And let the king give her royal position to another who is better than she. And the king's sentence, which he will make, will be heard throughout all his kingdom, for it is vast, and all women will give respect to their husbands, great and small. The eunuchs and the men who had access to the king were his closest advisors. It was a dangerous position to be in, right? Although it was customary for him to consult his advisors, it was still dangerous. If the king didn't like what you said, he could kill you. And that was not without precedence. Memucan diplomatically addresses the severity of the situation in verse 16, middle of verse 16. He deflects the attention away from the king and his stupidity, and he lays the responsibility squarely on the shoulders of Vashti. And then the ramifications for the realm. Queen Vashti has committed iniquity, moral perversity, right? She is sinning against not only the king, but also against all the princes and all the peoples who are in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus. This is huge, right? It's going to cause a role reversal, right, throughout the Persian Empire, right? The wives are going to stand up to their husbands. For the word about the queen will get out and all the women, to all the women, causing them to despise their husbands in their eyes, saying, well, Vashti did it to Ahasuerus, right? Who are you? Right, and they'll speak out the same way to their princes, and there'll be plenty of spite and plenty of indignation. Right, you can't have the balance of power in the home evened out. Verb despise in verse 17, spite in verse 18. Some translations use the word contempt. It carries the idea of trampling underfoot. This is the opposite of the word glory that Ahasuerus displayed in verse 4. While the king was displaying his royal glory to his important subjects, Vashti trashed it in a word. And unless something was done quickly, the same would happen throughout the Persian Empire. And homes would be upset. And homes would be broken up. And male leadership would be trashed. It was a massive reversal of the Medo-Persian way of life, one that affected the men from every part of the realm that he was trying to garner support for his upcoming invasion. Again, the fragility of it all is crazy. And again, this is hilarious. Verse 19, if it seems good to the king, let the royal word go forth from him and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media so it cannot be repealed, that Vashti may no longer come into the presence of King Ahasuerus, and let the king give a royal position to another who is better than she. And the king's sentence, which he will make, will be heard throughout the kingdom, for it is vast, and all the women will give respect to their husbands, great and small. Now, aside from the control of power here, this is very expedient advice on Memucan's part. Due to the fact that the laws and the Persians could not be repealed, right, the deposition of Vashti ensured that there would be no retaliation on the king's advisors. All these things are going on here, right? Each man was acting, or each man or woman was acting in their own best interest, right? Ahasuerus for his glory, Vashti probably for her dignity, Memucan and the wise men for their own retention of power in the home and possibly their lives for the future. All was being used by God. Here's the point. All being used by God to depose the queen and open up the place for another. Indeed, one better than she. Better is the word tov used again. And there is a note of irony here in the punishment. Vashti had refused to come into the presence of the king when she was summoned, verse 11, verse 17. And now she will be barred from ever coming into his presence again, verse 19. In the text, the phrase, her royal position, is emphatic. This is just the thing that the writer is trying to highlight for us, that he wants us to linger on. The door is now open for a new queen. Again, it's not that the Persian kings didn't have multiple wives. They did. But Vashti, as will Esther, had an influence over the king that proved to be incredibly powerful and incredibly strategic. Baldwin says, Vashti forfeited her influence by breaking the unspoken rule that it should be wielded in private. And thus it would be passed on to someone better than she. Better in what sense? More beautiful? More virtuous? Yeah, we'll see. Chapter closes, verse 21 and 22. And this word was good in the eyes of the king and the princes. And the king did according to the word of Memucan. So he sent letters to all the king's provinces, to each province according to its script, and to every people according to their tongue, that every man should be a ruler in his own house and the one who speaks in the tongue of his own people. Again, this is supposed to be hilarious. You have to have an irrevocable law for that? But it was good in the eyes of the king. Good is the word tov again. And the word went out. Apparently the Persian Empire had quite a postal system. It was a pony express system, a relay system. They could take a message from the citadel in Susa all the way to the western coast and the town of Sardis in less than a week. It covered a distance of over 1,200 miles. Again, note the irony. Here we have the greatest king in the Persian Empire in terms of land and power. He puts it all on display for his people. He's done it for the last 6 months, right? He's had them all come and view it for themselves. And he ends the chapter trying to save his own dignity because he sought to jeopardize the dignity of his wife. Again, just to say it, wine is a mocker. Strong drink is a brawler. There is nothing good that will come from it. But see, God had a greater purpose. Right? To give the royal position of Vashti to another. To one that was better than she. And he was working that plan out, working behind the scenes, working invisibly, but all for the good and of his people and for the faithfulness of his purposes. Again, the words of Daniel ring true. Daniel 2, verse 20 and 21. Let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and might belong to Him. And He changes the times and the season. He removes kings, and we could add queens, and He establishes kings and queens. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. Again, He declares the end from the beginning. And He faithfully, invisibly brings it to pass. Beloved, we need to be encouraged by this. God is working in our lives. Always working, semper fi, always faithful. Though we cannot always see it. We cannot always interpret it. Even though we can't always understand it, we can certainly trust His designs. This is the backstory for chapter 2. This is God working behind the scenes to make room for Esther to become queen. And this is meant to encourage us when we are behind the scenes of our future, that God is at work, faithfully orchestrating and faithfully working it out for our good and His glory. Beloved, if He put His Son to death on our behalf, how will He not also with Him freely give us all things? Romans 8. This is the point. God is good. God is faithful. God is working. And we must trust that. Father in heaven, we thank You for Your faithfulness and even the opportunity to see it behind the scenes as You bring the pagan king that You want in power into power, and how You use His own folly and the issues of his home to turn the tide and make room for the person that You want to be in the royal house at the right time. Lord, thank You for Your faithfulness. Thank You for Your providence. Thank You for Your goodness and grace. Thank You that You have directed those things towards us in the Lord Jesus Christ. In His name we pray. Amen.